Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Good morning from absolutely stunning Pritchard Hill. This is Ilona Thompson with Palate Exposure. I have the privilege this morning of sitting down with David Arthur Long of David Arthur Vineyards, a name a lot of you are very familiar with. He's the founder of the brand and a really extraordinary human being that I've had the privilege to run into over time. And now we get to sit down and have a chat. There's so many questions that I want to ask, and I think I'll start with the background. Where were you born?
Born San Jose, California.
Bay Area boy.
Okay. Bay Area boy, school of Palo Alto through high school, and then school at University of Denver, of course, mm-hmm. Colorado for a couple of years. And then my background is actually pottery.
Pottery?
I'm a potter.
Are you serious?
Yeah,
oh my God, how cool.
You didn't know that. And so I was, I mean, really, in my father's view, I was playing with mud. And my father used to introduce me as his son, the underwater basket weaver, as I had two older brothers that became lawyers, and I just couldn't follow that route. So I dropped out of school in Colorado, and when I was 22, I opened... let's go back. When I dropped out of school, I went to work washing dishes and then bussing tables. And then a friend of mine, John McIntosh, whose family owned the Coco's Reuben chain, invited me to come and learn to cook for them, which I did. And I, you know, once again, I had no degree, no nothing, no education. So I learned to cook and was actually a short order cook for about a year. And then I went into dinner house operations. I learned some dinner house cooking and, of course, bartending and all that goes with that. And then I thought, well, you know, I went into management with this company, learned to manage both these restaurants, and maybe another year went by, and I thought, if you can manage them, you can own them. So I opened my first restaurant in Boulder, Colorado. It was a 10-table, 40-seat fondue restaurant. And I always say, fondue is the bottom of the food chain. If you can't learn to boil some wine, right, and then add some grated cheese to it and cut up some bread cubes, you should not be in this business at all. So that was what I did. I had a fondue restaurant. I didn't make two nickels throw together. And I had that for maybe 3 or 4 years. And then one night in Boulder, my father called me and he said, what are you doing tonight? And again, he called me from Palo Alto or Los Altos where my parents were living. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, Dad, the roads are icy right now in Boulder. I said, not much business tonight. He says, I said, we're probably going to close early. He said, I understand. He says, but what are you doing? Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm drinking. Mm. He said, what are you drinking? I said, I'm drinking some Napa Valley Chenin Blanc. He said, really? And I said, yeah, why do you say that like that? And he said, did you know that your mother and I bought property in Napa Valley back in the 50s? I said, no. He says, as a matter of fact, one of the reasons for my call is, he says, you know, your mother and I helped put, you know, well, your brothers, you know, both finished undergrad school like you never did. Mm-hmm. And finished grad school like you never did, and, you know, became lawyers, and we helped put them, you know, through the school and then got them set up into their practices, and you never asked for any money. Mm-hmm. And I said, I never knew there was any money. I would have asked. And he said, we have this idea, and you can take it or leave it, but your mother and I, before something happens to us, and, you know, you can never even up everything between you kids perfectly. but we'd like to offer you this opportunity to take the money that we would spend on you for your college education, and maybe you plant 10 acres of grapes on the property in Napa Valley, which there was no road here, no water, no power, no nothing. There was no other vines here. And I said immediately, I was interested. I said, yeah, this sounds great. And so I sold my restaurant in Boulder, came out to California, started clearing land in 1978.
Wow.
Thought I'd have it cleared for planting by 79. It was a bigger project than I thought. 1980, finally ready to plant. I plant my first grapevines in 1980. So really, I now have been a farmer for about 40 years.
So Judgment of Paris happened in 76. You've heard of it, I assume, and you're very aware of it.
Yeah.
Has that influenced your activity here?
I think only, and I think I probably speak for a lot of people, when that's happened and that's behind you and you realize that you truly can compete on the world stage of wines, it does a lot for you. It's what lets you go forward. It's what gets you past a lot of dark times that you know you can produce world-class wines.
This is such, this is an understatement of a century, but it's a super rocky hill. How did you manage to clear it? I mean, this is so expensive and labor intensive. I'm just picturing going back in time to the 70s and you working solo or, oh my God, by yourself.
By myself.
How did you do it?
You know, it's just, of course, you hire out things like, the heavy equipment operation. You're bringing up these big Caterpillar tractors, these D8s and D9s. And so it was always interesting. Before the guys would start ripping in the field, clearing rock, they thought their machines were so tough.
Yeah.
And you'd go half a day, and you would see a ripper shank torn in half, a piece of steel so thick, just torn in half. And they couldn't believe it was done. So it's really hard on equipment, all equipment. You know, not only just the heavy equipment, clearing land side, of course, which that equipment's really built for that.
Yeah.
But even once the heavy equipment leaves, and now you have farming equipment, which I have to tell you about that.
Yeah.
After I developed water up here and brought in power from like 3-4 miles away, and hired like helicopters to set poles and string lines, crazy projects, I was out of money. I had spent all my money. So I didn't have the money. I had the money to build, I built a barn for a tractor.
Yeah.
But I had no money to buy the tractor to put in that barn. And so for the first 10 or 11 years that I was a farmer in Napa Valley with no tractor.
Wow.
So I used to borrow tractors from other farmers down in the valley. I would do their farming for them, for the use of the tractor, bring the tractor up on the hill up here, drive it up Sage Canyon Road to Highway 128, going 16 miles an hour, that was top speed on a tractor, get it up here, do my farming up here, and then return the tractor. So my little barn remained empty. And so it was in 1984, I think, that actually my daughter Laura, who's the general manager of David Arthur, it was Laura's mom, Joy, that said, you know what? You need to get another job. And I said, I'm already in the vineyard like all day long. What would I do? She said, well, you know how to make wine. Because I started making alcohol when I was 14 years old, which is kind of another story.
Oh, we can
so she said,
go there.
She said, you know how to do this. And we have this empty barn. Why don't we make wine in our barn? So in 1985, I bought 20 French oak barrels, and David Arthur Vineyards, the winery side, was born.
How did you learn how to make wine?
So how this happened. Living in Los Altos Hills, and this is right back in the day when the Beatles, I think, were on Ed Sullivan. And I'm on the school bus, and I see a new kid on the bus. And so I befriend him, and I'm kind of telling him what school's going to be like. And, you know, after the first 10 minutes, he says to me, I make Applejack. And I said, what is that? And he said, well, you get unpasteurized apple juice. And he said, you have it in the jug. And he goes, I put a nylon stocking over it so no bugs get in. He goes, I just hide it in the back of my closet for about 2 weeks. It turns to alcohol.
Yeah. So that's priceless.
I had to try it. So I got the unpasteurized apple juice. If you do this, you need to pour a little bit out first because there's an expansion problem with fermentation. But I got this apple juice and put the stocking over it and hid it in the back of my closet. I was 14 years old. And as a 14-year-old, once it's hidden back in the closet, I forgot that it was there. So a couple weeks go by, and I go, oh, my God, I should check on this. So I pull it out to look at it. I take off the cheesecloth, the nylon stocking, I guess what I had. And I look in there, and it had what looked like little clouds floating all over the top of this juice. And, of course, you know, those are not clouds. Those are colonies of mold. But I could take a tube and paddle those little clouds out of the way, mm-hmm. and just, yeah, I could get nuts. And so that was how I started. And so then I just had to clean up my act on, you know, getting some sulfur in the right time. And
you little alchemist, you.
Well, you know, that's, fermenting juice is about as basic as you get. Remember, they had me when my daughter Laura was at elementary school. Mm-hmm. And I always think, what other town could you do this in except for St. Helena? They invited me in to teach the kids how to make wine. And so we made wine with watermelon. We made wine, of course, of grapes. I had the kids pick out different fruits. We would squeeze those, right? And we would add a little packet of yeast to it. And then what the kids were to do was to, you know, follow the fermentation. And so...
Why didn't I go to that school?
You know, I just think it's so simple. It's something that, you know, could go on, but I think if I was in another school district where I did that, I think, would I be out of jail yet?
No, but I think it's, you know, if you don't make it a taboo, I think it's actually healthy for the kids to learn what the process is. I mean, and why not?
It's mainstay of the valley they live in.
Yeah, I mean, why hide from it? Why? That's a whole other subject of discussion. So that was your first fermentation job.
Yeah.
So somehow it filed away somewhere in your mind.
And my wife always knew that I would probably go back to that anyway. And so she said, let's just get out in front of it, and why don't you just make wine? So I was growing Chardonnay at the time.
Okay. Just Chardonnay.
Just Chardonnay.
Okay.
Just Chardonnay, which this is really the wrong ground for Chardonnay, which I had to figure that out too. Mm-hmm. So I took our Chardonnay in. Happened to be that year, unfortunately, it was a bumper crop in 85. Mm-hmm. Huge crop. And I had so much Chardonnay to sell that, of course, you know, when the wine was... I think when we bottled it in 86, and my wife and I were these brand new, you know, winery people. Mm-hmm. It's then, you know, it's okay, it's growing the grapes is one thing, and making the wine is one thing. All these are, you know, pretty simple. And then it's the sales side, which I had, once again, no experience in sales.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of Chardonnays coming out then. It was just very, very popular. And I can still remember going to the Sunshine Foods in St. Helena. And my wife and I had a little Honda station wagon. And we would put, you know, 5 or 10 cases of wine, probably 5, maybe 10 was too many for the weight, I can't remember. But we'd put some wine in our station wagon. And we would go to the stores and the Sunshine, I remember more than others, that my wife would be in the car and I would go into the store and go to the back, right? And I would wait my turn to show my wine to the buyer. And finally it would be my turn, and I would pour some Chardonnay for him, and he would say, oh, very nice Chardonnay. You know, well done. Nice job. And me thinking, okay, you know, he's going to buy now. And instead he would say, you know, David, I've got a lot of Chardonnays on the shelf right now. As soon as I worked on my inventory, we'd love to bring you in. And I really needed to sell a case of wine. So I would just pester him until finally I would wear him down. And he would say, okay, all right, one case. I would go to the car, because I had the case right there. I would bring it right back in. He would sign the invoice for the wine that I delivered him. I would then go back out to the car, where my wife would then go into the front of the store, like a regular grocery shopper, and go into the wine department and say, I've been looking all over for David Arthur Chardonnay. Do you happen to have any? And he says, well, matter of fact, well, we just got some in. My wife would buy a bottle back right then, but before she left that store, she would parade up and down each aisle saying to anyone that she came into, like, can you believe they've got David Arthur here? I can't believe it. And we would do this over and over again at each store we would go to.
That's extraordinary.
It was guerrilla marketing. It was horrible.
You know what? A lot of marketers this day that talk about authentic storytelling, I had to try that, selling a case at a time. I think it's really good training ground.
It was horrible. I'm thankful to be where I am now, but there's so many times in this business that you're just, you know, you're not sure.
Yeah.
Can we make it?
Yeah.
Can we make it? It's never been a straight path.
Wow. Well, you must have had an extraordinary stamina, but also there's some part of you that believed.
I think I believed, and I also, you know, I didn't know what would be next if I did fail.
Yeah.
So, and that can be, I don't know if that in and of itself is enough to make a person go, and I think probably it was for me,
yeah,
that I was afraid of failure, and so you're going to work harder because you don't know what's out there that could be a lot worse than what you're doing, and obviously having vineyards and being up here is a pretty cool life, and I didn't want to lose that.
It's beautiful, but with this largesse comes so much responsibility. It's a lot to handle.
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, you know, I think back, and it was my wife and myself. To now, it's, you know, I could never even afford a full-time vineyard crew. And now we have our vineyard crew that they have the option. They can work year-round. They're cross-trained to work in the winery.
Okay.
So they learn winemaking as well as care of the vines.
Oh, that's fascinating. I don't hear that often.
Yeah,
usually
no.
There's a strict separation of vineyard and cellar.
And it used to be that way for me too. And then this goes back about maybe 10 or 12 years ago, maybe it's more.
Yeah.
Where I looked at what was going on, and that you bring people in each year to work in the vineyard, then they go away, and you're lucky if you get any of those people ever back. So it's this brand new crew that's got to be retrained on everything.
Yep.
And I thought, I have enough to do for them to be here year-round. So, in fact, when the building that you're in right now, when these walls were plastered, I can remember I got a bid from local plaster company, if you will, to, mm-hmm. and I think it was $60,000 or $70,000
mm-hmm.
to plaster the walls. And I said, would this person, what if I paid for them for a day? Would they come up and train my people to do it?
Wow.
So I picked five people from the vineyard, brought them and said, would you like to learn a new craft that ultimately you can leave me and have this craft? And I think four of the five did move on and work for plaster companies. But I took those five people and they learned the craft of applying French plaster. And I did it for, I mean, I think the whole thing, from 60,000, I think the whole thing cost me about 5,000. And I've kind of had to do things like that.
I'm hearing a lot of entrepreneurial talk. I mean, you see the situation, you're a problem solver. If you don't have $70,000, then you find a way around it. Where did that come from in you? Do you have family background that...
My dad. My mom and my dad, for sure. You know, my parents were these little... My father was a butcher.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. We have a wine called Le Boucher, means the butcher.
I had no idea.
Yeah,
it's
an honor of my father.
Cool.
My father himself is a guy that he never got past the eighth grade, but retired at 33 years old. Just a smart guy, a street smart guy who was in the Merchant Marines.
Okay.
So never got past the eighth grade,
uh-huh.
Went into the Merchant Marines, came out. I think it was a buddy of his that was on a boat with that said, you know, what are you going to do
mm-hmm.
when you get out? And I think the friend was going to learn the craft of cutting meat. And he says, hey, you know, why don't you come do this until you figure out what you want to do? Turns out my father loved cutting meat. Loved it. And opened a little meat market. He rented some space in a little market in Palo Alto called the Homer Market. And his entire meat counter was probably maybe 6, maybe 9 feet long. And I can remember as a child, if there was 2 butcher blocks in there, I can remember my parents having me, they'd put out some butcher paper, lift me up on the butcher block, and I would sit there and talk to my father while maybe my mother did some book work, right? The book work for the little butcher shop. You know, and then I'd leave with my mother and go on do errands with her. And then my father, he grew this little butcher shop. The gentleman was retiring that owned the grocery store and came to my father and said, hey, I'm going to retire. I could sell this, but, you know, you've done so well in the butcher department. Why don't you take over the grocery? And my father said something like, gee, you know, I don't know anything about retail grocery. And this gentleman said, yeah, but you didn't know anything about cutting meat either, and you've become pretty successful at that. People would drive from San Francisco. They would send their butlers, their chauffeurs, down to Palo Alto to his store to get all these special cuts of meat. So he was really good at what he did. So in 1956, my father opened what I believe was the first supermarket south of San Francisco. He opened it in a town called Ladera behind Stanford Shopping Center, behind Stanford University. Mm-hmm. And my father, even though he had this 8th grade education, he was really good at watching purchasing practices of people. And he saw that there was all these professors coming from all over the world to teach at Stanford. You know, and what did they eat? Well, they ate things like caviar. So in 1956, when he opened the store, we had, I believe, 22 different brands of caviar in this little store. And it was all then also, of course, it was about the meats, it was about great produce, it was about service. If you had a bag the size of your purse, it was carried out to your car. No ifs, ands, or buts. It was carried to your car. And when we got out to your car, if you had dogs in there, we knew the names of your dogs. We knew where in the car you wanted that bag put. We knew whether you wanted it inside the car or you liked it in the trunk. We would learn your name. And this was how my father made his money. So the store was very successful and catering to people that appreciated this. And he said he retired early, and yeah.
I can only say I have goosebumps. You can witness it because this really touches me at the core, that art, that unfortunately lost art of service.
Thank you. I agree.
You witnessed it from, you know, day one, from the time you were. That has to have a monumental imprint on who you are.
I believe with our winery here, and it's something that I talk to, you know, thankfully the people that I have that work with me, and I say not for me, they work with me. It totally is. It's a group effort. You can call it, you know, people like call it team.
Yeah.
I'm reluctant to say team because I hear that at Target. You know, I hear a team representative, your Target team. So, you know, so I'm going to call it group. So our group here, what we'll try to do is, if we know a group is arriving for a tour, we will try to, it's not just enough to have a glass of wine and for them to walk in the door, but if you see them coming, greet them out of the gate, greet them out of their car with a glass of wine. Just try and, you know, they're here to have a great time. I have a story about, can I break the story about my
oh, absolutely, no, this is your story, so I'm you really know, excited to hear it.
People are here to have a good time, and that was my oldest brother, who was practicing attorney in St. Helena for years. I think to take a break from his practice one day, he drove up from St. Helena, drove up on the hill up here, and he joined me in a tour that was already going on. And maybe there was, I don't know, there was 5 people, and he was the 6th one or 7th one. But he joined me, and he had a glass of wine with all of us, and saw what a good time it was. And we got to the end, and, you know, we're hugging everyone, and we're saying goodbye and sending people out to their cars. And my brother said, you know what you are? And I said, what? He says, do you know what you are? And I said, well, you're probably going to tell me. I said, what am I? He said, you're a cog in the wheel. And I said, that doesn't sound very good. He says, no, no, no. He says, you're a cog in the wheel of people's good time. He said, no one comes to see you because they're expecting to have a bad time. They're expecting to have a good time. You get to have a good time with them. He said, look at my job as a lawyer. He said, no one comes through my office because they're there to have a good time. Their choices are, they're either suing someone or they're being sued. And I thought, that is horribly grim. That just, and I'm, you know, so glad I chose what I did.
No, this is, there's so much insight here. And I can tell you guys, I'm just going to make a sidetrack comment, but I think it's important. When I came to the Valley, I was just some, you know, blonde trotter that was utterly fascinated by wine. And David was one of the first people that I ran into, kind of serendipitously perhaps. And the amount of warmth and hospitality I experienced just from that moment, and you didn't know who I was, but you treated me like an old friend from the get-go. And I could not wrap my brain around it, but I knew it felt so damn good. So you're one of the reasons I stayed. So he has this hospitality spirit in spades, and it comes across as so real. It's not just, hey, you're here, so I'll just put on a smile. It's really, truly you.
Oh, thank you.
So back to the 70s, I have to just ask you,
sure,
this just being on this gorgeous, I mean, that's such an inadequate comment. This hill is magic. Every time I come here, it's like, wow. But the other side of it, actually, what you described is extraordinary effort. And not having any background, any formal background, you just kind of had to figure it out on the job.
Yeah, you do. You know, you do what you have to do, and sometimes it is so blind and it's done so ignorantly. But you do. You do. That said, I can remember my father bringing me up here on my first trip to Napa Valley when I decided this is what I was going to do. And we're driving around, and my father said, you know, we're going to make some stops. I'm going to introduce you to some people. This is even back in the day when Christian Brothers was still going.
Oh, cool.
And, of course, my parents knew some people at Christian Brothers, and I was with this one gentleman for part of a day and someone else for the day. But I can remember I went to the office, the agricultural office for, I think it was Christian Brothers, maybe it was Barrington, the Christian Brothers. And I was in this office for a few minutes, and this guy said to me, and it should have scared me away, it didn't, but he said, you know, who do you think you people are that can just come to the Valley and learn this business, something we've been doing for years? You know, I have my master's in viticulture, and you just think you're going to come in here and do this. And I'll tell you, when I got done hearing that, I got back in the car, I was pretty deflated. I was pretty deflated. Now, to this person's credit, oh my, this is so wild, about, from that day forward, it must have been about 15 years later, I ran into him at the gas station in St. Helena, and he recognized me, and he came over to me, and he said, congratulations on your success.
Aww.
So, you know, it was nice to see him come around, and it felt really good to hear it from him, this guy that said, you know, what are you doing? Why are you here? So that was a good feeling.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.